But it'd be a great honor to introduce our next presenter, Jen Trezano. I met Jen about 5 or 6 years ago at the National Legal Aid and Defenders Association Leadership Training. And I had read some of his work previously, and I knew that he had done extensive work in the area of indigent defense. And he wound up sharing primary studies and reports that he had done over the years. And has really helped provide some nice counsel and guidance to our organization, myself personally, and I think really our state task force on indigent defense is better based on the relationship that we form. He serves as the president and co-founder of the Justice Project and has been involved in social justice issues for more than 25 years. As the president of the Justice Project, John is instrumental in working to improve criminal justice systems both at the state and national level through public education, litigation support, and legislative reform efforts. John is also a veteran of Vietnam. And when he returned to the States, he was the co-founder for the Veterans for America, formerly known as the Vietnam Veterans of America Foundation, an international humanitarian organization that addresses causes, conduct, and consequences of war through programs, advocacy, and service for victims of conflict around the world. Under his leadership, his organization and work on an international campaign to ban landmines was recognized with the Nobel Peace Prize. John is going to talk some today about some of the work that he and his staff have done over the years, and we'll be addressing opportunities that we have to enhance the quality of evidence relied upon in criminal courts and ways to modernize criminal justice to make it more fair and accurate. Please welcome John Trezano.
Thanks very much, Jim, and Judge Hervey and all members of this criminal justice integrity. And I really do appreciate the opportunity to come down here and spend a little bit of time with you and help you understand and assist you in your efforts as you try to work to move forward on criminal justice reform. You know, Americans have this basic fundamental belief in the fairness and accuracy of our criminal justice system. We want to believe that the person who's accused of a crime, convicted of that crime, and then sentenced to prison or death for that crime is actually the person that committed the crime. But what we've learned over the years, and a lot of this has really come true since the advent of DNA technology, is that we cannot be assured in all of our cases that we're getting it right. And in fact, what it has shown is that we have a system that is flawed, if not necessarily broken. We have found that evidence that's being presented during criminal trials that is significantly less reliable than what we'd ever thought before. We have found that the actions of defense attorneys, prosecutors, and law enforcement, both intentional and unintentional, have had a direct hand in the hundreds of wrongful convictions around the country. For over 8 years, the Justice Project has been a leader in the effort to prevent wrongful convictions and reform the systemic problems that plague our criminal justice system. Our mission is rooted in the basic belief that if you want to affect change, you've got to engage the law. And as such, the Justice Project's national agenda of reform includes recommendations for policy reform in 8 specific areas, ranging from eyewitness identification to recording of custodial interrogations, to adequate defense representation. But in order to address these common causes of wrongful convictions, and one of the ways that we utilize this is we produce and widely disseminate policy reviews, which I believe this committee has already received copies of. And these policy reviews outline recommendations for procedural improvements. It also provides the latest scientific research, pertinent case studies, and model statutes that jurisdictions can adopt. What we've done over the years is focus on very pragmatic and simple solutions that could enhance the accuracy and fairness in our criminal justice system. And the Justice Project is not alone in doing this. There's a number of other organizations that are doing it. There are a number of states that have reviewed the causes of wrongful convictions. Commissions in Illinois, California, and Virginia, for example, have studied how statewide policies or the lack thereof have led to wrongful convictions. The Remarkably, these commissions came to the very same conclusions regarding wrongful convictions. And so when it comes to preventing it, there's no need to reinvent the wheel. We know what causes it. And what we need to do is really implement the reforms that are necessary to make sure that it doesn't happen again. I really applaud the work that the Criminal Justice Integrity Unit is doing. And your quote, call to action to address the growing concerns with our criminal justice system. And you're correct when you say that it's now time to act and move for reform. As wrongful convictions have piled up in Dallas County and around this state, it is undeniable that mistakes in our system have reached a critical mass. Just last week, with the exoneration of Johnny Lindsay, a man who spent 26 years in prison for a rape he did not commit, the total number of years innocent people have spent behind bars in the state of Texas exceeds 500. And it has cost the state over $60 million to date in compensation alone. The state of Texas is the leader in the number of wrongful convictions exposed by DNA testing. And these mistakes represent not only terrible injustices to the wrongfully convicted, but also great public safety failures. I want to address today some of the most important opportunities we collectively have in modernizing our criminal justice system and improving the quality of evidence that is heavily relied on in criminal trials, including eyewitness testimony, custodial interrogations, informant testimony, forensic evidence, and DNA evidence. The Justice Project has found that deficiencies in the way this evidence is collected, documented, and preserved has had a direct hand in the shocking number of wrongful convictions, not only in Texas, but across the United States. I also want to emphasize that the single most important safeguard against wrongful convictions is access to quality defense representation. An adversarial system is reliable only when the evidence is investigated and challenged by a qualified, competent defense attorney with adequate resources. The solutions I want to talk about today are based on the need to modernize our criminal justice system, and they're based also on science and technology. While private enterprise is generally quite readily responsive to developments in technology and science in order to stay competitive, as we all know, sometimes governments lag behind. In several areas before us, particularly with response to recording, interrogation, and eyewitness identification, our systems have been slow to respond to innovations in technology and developments in science that have the potential to increase and enhance the accuracy and reduce the risk of error. Many of the needed reforms are simply efforts to incorporate the benefits of new technology and developments in our scientific understanding to improve existing procedures. Modernizing these procedures to collect, document, and preserve evidence enhance the accuracy and quality of that evidence when it's presented to jurors in a courtroom. Jurors in criminal cases are given an enormous responsibility. They have to consider all the facts, deliberate, and come to a verdict that will permanently affect the life of the defendant, the victim, and their respective families. Jurors cannot possibly come to a fair and reliable verdict or perform their duties responsibly when they're presented with false testimony, unreliable evidence, and the like. However, many of the practices and procedures used in our criminal justice system facilitate just that, the presentation of inaccurate evidence in the courtroom. The state of Texas must take steps to enhance the quality of evidence used to convict criminal defendants. Justice can only be achieved when criminal trials are accurate and when juries are provided all the tools they need to come to a fair and reliable verdict. Most importantly, the solutions and recommendations that I'm going to talk about today must have the reach and power appropriate for the magnitude of the problem. Therefore, the state must require change, not merely recommend it. Many of the reforms have been around for some time, and best practices have been available for those who wanted to take advantage of them. Yet the most important steps we can take to prevent wrongful convictions are still not implemented in the overwhelming majority of jurisdictions. These measures are critical to public safety and to our ability to deliver justice, and thus need to be required. We can no longer deny the fact that the criminal justice system here in Texas is seriously flawed, if not in fact broken. And many of the policies and procedures and practices currently used only put individuals at risk of wrongful convictions. And failure to reform these practices is simply, I believe, reckless. But fortunately, there are some very simple ways to fix these problems. And formation of this body is the critical step in doing so. And I encourage you, as I go through my presentation, if you want, just ask me questions. I want it to be a little bit more of a dialogue. As you know, Texas now leads the nation in wrongful convictions exposed by DNA. And according to our analysis of the cases, the vast majority, 84% of the cases, involve mistaken eyewitness identifications.
Harry, is that because states like California, who are bigger than we are, have better procedures or just don't check as well?
In terms of eyewitness identification, it's the leading cause of wrongful convictions around the country. And so, you know, here in Texas...
So why would Texas have a higher number than California when there's more conviction?
Well, some of that has... There's a number of factors in terms of that.
Some of that had to do with an anomaly in Dallas County where they historically used a private laboratory which kept evidence as opposed to a DPS-run laboratory where
they wasn't able to prove that it actually came out.
And what's the name of the lab in Dallas County?
Oregon Cellmark.
No, the one...
Swift, yes.
And so they have a treasure trove of physical evidence and biological evidence going back into the 1870s.
I just don't want to paint Texas as worse than Texas could be, because there's other states that are bigger. I don't know that there's any proof out there that says their systems are any better.
No.
We have, or are there any worse?
No, a lot of it has just what DSS.
We might be doing a better job of doing something.
Just go compare Dallas County with Harris County.
That's right.
Where most people think that Harris County would probably have three times the DNA exoneration that Dallas County had, but for the fact that they destroyed all the evidence.
And there's the same thing happening in Los Angeles or New York or Chicago or other places like that.
Hence the importance of story.
Right.
You know, as you heard this morning from John this morning, and the importance about having standards and procedures in terms of collecting evidence, the same is true with eyewitness evidence collection. You know, eyewitness evidence is very similar to physical trace evidence, in that if it's not collected very carefully, and according to scientifically informed principles and protocols, its evidentiary value can be damaged or severely ruined. This is why it's absolutely critical that police departments be required to adopt and follow a standardized protocol. Eyewitness evidence is too fragile and too important to conduct without a detailed protocol, and eyewitness evidence is vulnerable in many ways. Research, and you're going to hear a lot about this when Professor Gary Wells comes down and testifies later on this month, but research in the field of eyewitness memory has revealed that several natural psychological tendencies can undermine the accuracy of eyewitness identification.
Now, before you go there, let me ask one other question on the protocol. Does somebody have a design protocol in place that we should look at?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Who?
States like Minnesota, Wisconsin, New Jersey, Department of Justice has issued a protocol that has it. The International Chief of Police has issued a protocol.
So the DOJ has a protocol.
DOJ has a protocol. In fact, the model statute that we have in the policy review that we provided you is based on those protocols. For example, research has shown that eyewitnesses have a natural tendency to rely on what they call relative judgment when picking a suspect out of a lineup or a photo array, meaning that they will select whoever in the lineup looks most like the suspect in comparison to the other members of the lineup, as opposed to a more absolute assessment comparing the members of the lineup to their actual memory of the perpetrator. While relative judgment does impose a threat in instances where the suspect in the lineup is in fact the perpetrator, in cases where the suspect is in fact an innocent person, there's significant risk. And this is simply because someone in the lineup will resemble the perpetrator more than others. It's just a fact. If that person happens to be a filler and the filler is picked, then the witness's identification will be discounted. But if that person happens to be a suspect, then an incorrect ID can have devastating consequences, especially if that suspect is actually innocent. And this tendency, or what is sometimes called comparison shopping, is a significant problem given the great pressure eyewitnesses feel to identify a culprit and help solve a crime. Additionally, a lot of research has conclusively established that eyewitnesses' degree of certainty regarding an identification can be greatly influenced by reinforcing feedback from law enforcement or others, regardless of whether or not that feedback is intentional. For example, a witness might make an identification that is somewhat tentative, but after being exposed to other information that seems to reinforce the correctness of the pick, the witness may offer a compelling, highly confident in-court identification that bears little resemblance to the more modest degree of confidence that person may have had when the initial identification was made. This sort of malleability of self-assessment of certainty or confidence in response to feedback is nothing other than a natural tendency of human psychology. And our procedures need to recognize it and be structured to minimize this problem. Perhaps the most important procedure Texas must require is simply the careful documentation of a complete identification procedure, along the lines of what you were saying is currently being thought about at least by Senator Rodney Ellis. When a witness is presented with a photo array or a live lineup, there are currently no clear requirements for documenting it carefully and completely. The jury, in most cases, does not know exactly what the witness said regarding the various members of the lineup, what the level and content of the dialogue with the investigators, and perhaps most importantly, how the witness would characterize his or her degree of certainty in any identification made. And during trial, what is presented to the jury regarding the identification procedure is often an incomplete picture reconstructed from memory. Such a critical procedure comprehensively. Identifying a perpetrator is an absolute pivotal moment in any criminal preservation of photos in a photo array or photographs taken of a live lineup and their degree of confidence in their identification. His own words prior to any feedback from any authorities. The best way to do this, of course, is to electronically record it. Very simple. At a minimum, an inexpensive digital audio recorder should be used to record the witness and the administrator's dialogue. But a video record of the whole proceeding would be preferable. Important for folks to understand that the prospect of confidence in identification being inflated over time is not malfeasance on anyone's part, but simply the result of human psychology. Witnesses are, of course, very motivated to give the right answer, to the point that their self-reported level of certainty can evolve without even the awareness of the witness. There's one reason why comprehensive documentation is so critical. The jury needs the whole picture in order to weigh the evidence before it. When an eyewitness identifies a defendant during trial, there's a lot of background information the jury must have access to in order to evaluate that identification. The jury has the need and really the right, I believe, to know if the witness' degree of confidence has changed from the initial identification, if the defendant stood out in the lineup with a photo spread compared to the other members, or if the witness received any reinforcing feedback from law enforcement. Without these facts, the jury is presented an inaccurate picture, and they are denied the tools they need to properly evaluate the evidence and to reach a fair and reliable verdict. Documenting eyewitness identifications will not account, however, for some of the current flaws in procedures that are used. Traditional procedures for conducting photo arrays and live lineups have been developed ad hoc over the years without the benefit of any scientific research. And basically, current procedures seem intuitively plausible to all the stakeholders in the system, be it the police, the prosecutors, judges, defense lawyers, etc., as a fair way to evaluate and gather eyewitness evidence. And although the basic idea of a lineup is fair, the devil, as we all know, is always in the details. Fortunately, today we have a body of research that points the way to more accurate procedures for obtaining eyewitness evidence that can account for this known sources of error. And while many of these strategies for enhancing accuracy have been around for many years, the criminal justice system has been slow to respond. As I mentioned, the National Institute of Justice, Division of the U.S. Department of Justice, has issued two publications on eyewitness identification, one in 1999 and another in 2003. And many other groups, including the American Bar Association and the International Association of Chiefs of Police, have suggested such practices. Yet few jurisdictions have implemented some of these most important and proven strategies. Texas currently has no statewide requirement for eyewitness identification procedures. And in that sense, Texas is like the majority of states around the country. The Justice Project has recently surveyed all of Texas's police and sheriff's departments to determine what policies and procedures are in place regarding the conduct of eyewitness identification procedures. And what we have found is that the vast majority of departments have no written policies and procedures at all.
Now, did they all respond, or did how many?
No, we surveyed 1,044 departments. We got response from over 58%, 603 to be exact, responded. Out of those 603 who responded, 16%, 95 of them have policies. And we're in the process of analyzing all the data and the types of policies.
Did you get response from the major communities of Texas, San Antonio's and Austin, and Dallas? And
yes.
Yes, with the exception of San Antonio, the big cities did comply.
All San Antonio did not reply.
That's so far.
All right.
But it has really run the gamut, from pretty detailed policy, for example, in University Park, the suburb of Dallas.
They don't know that point.
To one department whose sole policy consists nothing other than making sure that the jail is notified in order to transport the suspect over to the police department. But this absence of protocols indicate a failure to account for the known sources of errors in eyewitness identification and eyewitness testimony. Updating and modernizing the procedures used in collecting and documenting eyewitness evidence demands little to no cost to the state and substantially increases the reliability of this type of evidence. And in order to prevent the alarming amount of mistaken eyewitness identifications that lead to wrongful convictions, I strongly recommend that Texas adopt written policies and procedures that provide a clear protocol for collecting eyewitness evidence. But what should be in the protocol? Perhaps the simplest thing we could do is ensure that the witness is given cautionary instructions, first and foremost, prior to the lineup starting, that the perpetrator may or may not be included in the lineup, and that the witness should not feel compelled to make an identification. This is an obvious fact, but the research has proven that by explicitly cautioning the witness in this way, wrongful identifications are substantially lowered, and there's no decrease in correct IDs. Regardless of whether a true perpetrator is in the lineup, an eyewitness, especially a victim eyewitness, quite naturally feels pressure to make an identification. Witnesses know that at the very least, a lineup contains a suspect. But when the real culprit is not in fact in the lineup, their presumption combined with a natural tendency to make a relative judgment of who looks most like the perpetrator may cause an eyewitness to identify an innocent person. So this small and very easily implemented procedure using cautionary instructions has been proven to be extremely successful in reducing false identifications, with no downside in correct identifications.
John, excuse me a second. I have talked to Tim Bratton from PCLOS, and they will be educating officers that at least they have to do the cautionary instruction.
That's very good. That is very good.
Good.
And again, part of this thing is, and we'll get into it more, it's just not recommending it. It's making sure that people are actually doing it. That's what's most important. We also need to make sure that policies include guidelines for how to select fillers in order to create a lineup that is fair and not suggestive in any way. Only one suspect should appear in a lineup. The filler should resemble the witness's description of the perpetrator rather than chosen to resemble the suspect, since doing the latter makes it harder for the witness than necessary. Finally, as we all know, the suspect should not unduly stand out. Take, for example, the case of Tim Cole, who was cleared of a love of rape based on DNA testing, but not until after he died in prison. When the photo array was presented to the victim eyewitness in this case, she was shown a group of standard jail mugshots along with one Polaroid shot of Cole. Now, I cannot go back and say with 100% certainty that the victim would not have picked Cole out of the lineup if it would have been, if his shot would have been the same as the others. But I don't think that there's any doubt that because this picture was different, that that did not lead to its wrongful conviction. I mean, to the wrongful identification. Clear requirements for composing lineups must be required as part of the lineup protocol and procedures that is utilized by every department. Additionally, Texas must implement procedures that ensure that a witness will not be influenced by unintentional feedback from the person administering the lineup. As such, Texas should adopt double-blind administration of lineups and photo spreads. Barry Scheck was here previously, and he talked extensively about that, especially, I believe, the computer model in terms of photo arrays. But at the very least, the person administering the lineup or the photo array should have nothing to do with the investigation and not know whether or not a suspect is actually going to appear. The most familiar example of the idea behind double-blind administration is when a new drug is tested through clinical trials. And we know what happens in clinical trials. They don't let the doctors who are administering the trials or the patients who are participating in the trials, whether or not they know they're receiving the actual drug or a placebo. That's not done because we think that the doctors or the patients may cheat. That's just done because that's what scientific protocol requires. And we should be doing the same thing when it comes to double-blind procedures and lineups. Sequential lineup procedures in which lineup members or photos are presented to a witness one at a time as opposed to all at once have also been identified as a promising strategy and tool in limiting eyewitnesses' tendency to engage in comparison shopping. While there have been questions raised about the value of sequential presentations, on balance, most experts believe that it has proven to be superior in both experimental research and in the field. Additional pilot studies are currently underway, and hopefully we'll be able, over the next year, to get more definitive information on sequential lineups. What I suggest that Texas does is allow people to either use sequential lineups or not, and just wait until some further science comes out. And the last eyewitness issue that protocols have to address is the inherent danger of repeated exposure to a suspect or a witness. If you take a look at Larry Fuller's case out of Dallas, the witness was presented with a photo spread initially that included Fuller's picture, and in the first photo array, she could not make an identification. However, she was later shown a second photo spread that also included Fuller. This time, the victim identified him as a rapist. But the only photo that occurred in both photo arrays was Fuller's, and all the colors were different. So did the victim remember his face from the previous array? Much of the research on eyewitness memory has looked at this phenomenon, what they call transference. That is, when we unconsciously transfer elements of our memory between events. It seems likely that that may would have happened in the Fuller case. There is also another example of a woman by the name of Jennifer Thompson, not a Texas case, but Jennifer Thompson 24 years ago was a young co-ed down in North Carolina when she was brutally raped. But while she was undergoing that horrific ordeal, she managed to study the individual's face and his features. And so she was able to distinctly see the face of her attacker, and she worked with the police to develop a composite sketch. The police did the composite sketch, and Jennifer's repeated exposure to that sketch affected her in such a way that when she was asked to identify a photo out of an array, she was using her memory of the composite sketch to make the selection, rather than the memory of her attacker. And when Jennifer was asked to identify her attacker out of a live lineup, she made a selection based on her memory of the photo she had selected. And finally, When she was asked at trial to identify her rapist, Jennifer made her selection based on her memory of the man she identified in the line, in the live lineup, which was based on her memory of the photo, which was based on her memory of the composite. Needless to say, Jennifer got it wrong. But this is not unusual, right? This is what happens. Our memory does not record events like a video recorder. Rather, our memory, and we're trying to reconstruct our memory, it's like putting a puzzle together. We get this piece of information, and that just adds to the picture. That's what transference is all about. And because human memory is so sensitive and so prone to change, it's imperative that law enforcement officials take every step possible to preserve a witness's original memory of the perpetrator and limit a witness's repeated exposure to the suspects of the crime. By requiring jurisdictions to adopt eyewitness identification policies that meet certain minimum standards, state of Texas will be joining, like I said before, states like North Carolina, Wisconsin, Minnesota, New Jersey, to have models of eyewitness reform. Let me just say a couple things about eyewitness identification that I think needs to be done here. And I'm very pleased to hear about the legislation with Senator Ellis. But the problems are grave enough, and the change is so important that we need to require, that jurisdictions change and not merely recommend changes. Best practices have been around for years, and we just have to make sure that they get implemented. And so Texas needs to establish a protocol and policies. And those policies include what I just talked about. Thorough documentation, preferably including electronic recording of lineups and photo arrays. A record of witness assessment of confidence or certainty in the identification in his or her own words prior to any feedback from anybody else involved in the procedure. Cautionary instructions, double-blind procedures, or some equivalent mechanism for eliminating the issue of inadvertent cueing, and the dangers of repeated exposure of a suspect to a witness.
John, if this were required, what a hammer would be held to see that it was followed?
Some jurisdictions, it's automatic exclusion of the identification. What some jurisdictions have is, you know, it's not as extreme, that there are exceptions if you cannot record, if it's justified, right? You know, maybe you can't do the equipment or whatever, but there are some exceptions in terms of this, but the most extreme is, of course, the exclusion. And I'm not proposing necessarily that the legislature actually do the whole policy protocol and procedures. But what it needs to do is that legislation mandating that needs to be specific enough to make sure that departments around the state are following at least these basic scientific principles and protocols.
And what method of education are you talking about using to be sure that protocols are understood?
Undoubtedly, in terms of all this, there has to be training. There has to be extensive training. When you're dealing with, I believe, with eyewitness identification or some of the other things, like recording custodial interrogation may not be as much. What is most important is that people understand what the law is. And as I'll get into later, for example, Texas has one of the best post-conviction DNA testing laws in the country. It's really a model for the rest of the country. Unfortunately, it's not being implemented properly, and that's a problem. A lot of that has to do with education, people knowing what it is that they need to do, and that's why establishing statewide policy and procedures, and everybody knowing that there are statewide policy and procedures that they have to follow, that's the best way.
When you're talking about documenting, when you're talking about video or audio taping, are you talking about the entire process?
I'm talking about the actual administration of the lineup or a photo array.
Where you get the witness, you know, you see the witness on the video looking at the pictures. And,
that's right. Okay. Because what you want to really get at and what the jury really, really needs, there's no doubt when a person comes to trial, that in-court identification, it's 100% certainty, right? There's very, very rarely is a is a witness going to get it up there and say, I think it's that person up there? They come in with 100% certainty by the time they get to trial.
Well, I mean, like I had a DNA exoneration this summer on one of my cases where one of the witnesses, I witnessed, was 100% certain in court. And then once we got to look at the DA's file on this 20-year-old case, there were notes in the file saying that the witness on the first picture showed up, didn't pick out anybody, even though this defendant was in there. Then they showed her another picture show up with him in there again, and she focused on somebody else for a long time, and then narrowed it down to two people, and then chose the defendant. Of course, none of that came out of trial. But if that's on a video,
that's on a video, or even if those notes, I mean, even just making sure, if you're not going to record it, but documenting that stuff and making sure that the defense lawyer and the juries know that. That's the important thing in terms of this process. You know, how this degree of certainty may or may not have changed over the course of the criminal investigation.
So what are the questions people are raising to the videotaping of these things?
It varies. Sometimes they say cost, but, you know, you can electronically record anything, you know, relatively cheaply. And the same thing with recording custodial interrogations. Almost every jurisdiction in this country, police department, have dash cams, and they rely on dash cams very much. We can put them in virtually all the police cars in this country. Why can't we have a camera in a recording room or, in a lineup room?
Now, what level of crimes are we looking at doing this for? Is it for death penalty cases or sexual assault or everything?
For all felonies.
All felonies.
Yeah. Okay. What we're talking about is good law enforcement procedures.
All felony charges that would be brought.
Yeah, if you're going to conduct a lineup and or a photo array in a felony case, you should have this type of procedure.
Okay. Are some of these other states videotaping these identification procedures now that you mentioned?
Yes. Yeah. Do you know which ones exactly?
I think, I'm not sure offhand, but I know that some jurisdictions do report.
And I've heard some people say that they are opposed to it because it's intimidating to the witness, or, you know, puts the witness in a position like they feel like they're being on their own trial, and those sort of objections.
I would suggest that you can, you know, if it's going to be uncomfortable like that, I would suggest that you can make an exception for that. To me, what is most important is that somebody is at least documenting this.
Is there limitations on juveniles?
Pardon me?
Are there limitations on juvenile witnesses? In any of those cases?
In juvenile?
I don't know that there are separate requirements for documenting juvenile witnesses.
For a felony adult, I'm not talking about a juvenile crime here, I'm talking about an adult crime, but the witness himself that you're talking about is a juvenile.
Yeah, I would suggest that if the witness is a juvenile, that'd be even more important to document what this individual is saying and or thinking.
Could I add something on that? Something I just have to disagree with you. If we're going to have procedures for witness identification or suspect identification or show-ups or lineups, I don't care if it's a misdemeanor or it's a felony. If you start doing them differently for misdemeanor, you're going to make mistakes on the felony. It's the same difference. You do it one way, and that's the way you always do it. This is the way we do it. And I don't care what the crime is. The bottom line is somebody might go to jail, and we need to do it right because you'll develop bad habits. And then am I dealing with a felony? A misdemeanor today, at some point in investigation, can turn into a felony 2 weeks later. You've already corrupted the witness and the case, so if we're going to do it, let's do it right for all of them.
This is the Austin Chief of Police, for those of you who don't know him. And he's very open-minded.
I would totally agree with that. There's, sometimes there's always this resistance on the part of folks that institute any type of change, and so they want to do it incrementally. But you're absolutely correct, because what you're talking about in terms of this type of simple procedure is nothing other than very, very good law enforcement practices. I believe that's what it is. And it should be throughout the system.
In several of the exonerations we've done, the Tim Cole case most recently, what we've run into as we go back and re-examine these cases is that you had an obviously flawed photographic procedure. That one was horrible. The Polaroid facility that clearly was different, and they had an idea in mind that they wanted her to pick that guy. But when that issue got raised in court, we ran into the doctrine of judicial discretion being exercised, and of course the familiar doctrine of the in-court identification is so strong that it doesn't make any difference what problems happened before. The judge finds that the independent recollection of the witness in the courtroom is overpowers whatever problems were had before. What about abolishing that element of judicial discretion? I'm sure it's a subject near and dear to the hearts of many in the room, but abolishing that kind of judicial discretion and judicial ability to save a bad identification, should be factored in?
Yes, it should.
Well, yeah, I was just thinking that. I mean, I think the focus of the policy is to prevent that lineup from being presented in the first place, and there's a separate question of whether a judge will intervene in any way to keep that out if there was a problem with the subjectivity. But the first priority has to be to make sure that when lineups are composed, they're composed according to protocols and preventing problems instead of trying to figure out how to deal with it after that. They're both, I do think though that we should look at strategies for dealing with those lineups that are suggested.
What do you think about videotaping as a separate issue from the protocol? I mean, the protocol's good, but the protocol's going to be a complicated issue to put into law, I guess. But videotaping, requiring videotaping, is real simple and just required to videotape. What kind of effect do you think that would have standing alone at avoiding the bad conditions?
I think that alone would certainly help because, again, one of the most important things you can do in terms of eyewitness identification is document the level of certainty the person has when they're making that identification. So anything that you do in terms of documenting that, right, be it from the initial photo array to a lineup, that is going to help you improve the quality of the witness identification.
Because there are a lot of studies out there that say that there is no relationship between certainty and reliability. It's one of the big things that Gary Wells talks about, that you can have a person on the stand who is 100% certain and 100% wrong. One of the earlier questions asked is, what are the objections to videotaping? And the one that was written as a minority report for the Ryan Commission in Illinois was that if you videotape these things, you're going to create another source of potential cross-examination by criminal defense lawyers of the procedures and the methods used, the interrogation, the questions, whether they were using read technique or whatever it may be, that you just create this body that otherwise didn't exist that favors the defense.
Isn't that the whole point?
It was the whole point of the minority dissent.
Well, that leads us right into recording of custodial interrogations. Confessions and are often as just like an 100% witness identification, you know, the certainty in a trial. Confessions are often the most powerful evidence against a defendant because the idea that someone would actually confess to a crime that they did not commit, most people don't understand that. However, false confessions are a well-documented reality. They've resulted in wrongful convictions and the incarceration of innocent people in Texas and the rest of the country. Indeed, in Texas alone, out of the DNA exonerations that have occurred to date, 10% of the wrongful convictions involve false confessions. Confessions are so powerful that they can overcome other exculpatory evidence. They carry more weight than eyewitness in any type of character or testimony, and juries don't discount confessions even when they're logically and legally appropriate to do so. given the documented cases of false confessions, and I said Texas is 10%, but around the country it's 25% of all exoneration cases to date have involved false confessions. And given the research indicating that false confessions occur with alarming frequency, I believe it is imperative that we update the practices and procedures on how...
John, are you going to give us some examples of that research you just talked about? You get it then.
Yeah, and again, that's in the policy reviews. What people have shown, the best way to prevent this is record custodial interrogations from beginning to end. From the moment that Miranda warnings are initially given throughout the whole interrogation. Texas currently requires that oral confessions are recorded. However, there's no provision in Texas law stating that the interrogation itself must be recorded. And this places law enforcement, prosecutors, and innocent victims at risk because we're only provided with the product of the interrogation rather than the process itself. Implementation of electronic recording of custodial interrogation, again, incurs minimal cost, especially when you compare it to the astronomical cost of wrongful convictions. Indeed, in Texas, there is already some jurisdictions that do record. From large metropolitan areas like Austin and Houston and the Dallas Police Department, they do it for homicides and violent felonies, to very small towns. So the fact that you have large metropolitan areas doing it in small towns tells you that it is a practice and a policy that anybody can do. It's urgent to record interrogations, I think, when you're really talking about vulnerable populations such as juveniles or those with mental illness. One wrongful conviction case here in Texas demonstrates what happens when a jury is deprived of all the facts surrounding the confession. That's the Christopher Ochoa case. And I don't need to go into the details about that case or what happened or how long he was subject to interrogation, but we've known the results. Of that. One of the things that the Justice Project has done here in Texas is we've located and interviewed some of the jurors from the Richard Danziger case, who was his co-defendant. And each juror stated that they had known that Ochoa had been interrogated for 20 hours and actually observed some of the techniques that had been used that would have factored significantly in their deliberations. Surprisingly, initially when it was being advanced that recording of custodial interrogations would be done, it wasn't just law enforcement that objected. Defense objected in a lot of jurisdictions because it took away one of the tools in their arsenal, motions to suppress statements. But what recording of custodial interrogation does is it makes sure that we have a fair and accurate recording of what is being done in the procedure. And there's really no reason why we should not be doing that. Another area I want to touch on is jailhouse informant testimony. It also poses real challenges to fairness and accuracy in criminal trials. When the state offers a benefit in exchange for testimony, whether that benefit is explicit or implied, the incentive for incarcerated individuals to fabricate evidence increases dramatically. Informants may even fabricate testimony in an effort to curry favor with prosecutors, apart from any promise or implied benefit. The protections currently in place to prevent perjured testimony, such as the use of cross-examination, have quite honestly proven starkly inadequate over the years to safeguard against false testimony by witnesses with powerful incentives to lie. And remarkably, the use of informant testimony continues to be largely unregulated by state legislatures or courts, despite frequent documented instances of wanton abuse. And this lack of regulation is true in Texas as it is in virtually every jurisdiction around the country. And there's no existing policies or statutes that people are following. However, the role informant testimony plays in wrongful conviction demands regulations. Informant testimony is involved in 15% of wrongful conviction cases around the country. And in Texas, it's over, been involved in over 13% of the cases, so right in line with the rest of the country. In order to ensure that only the most reliable, truthful, and credible information, informant testimony is presented to juries, the state should adopt rules requiring mandatory automatic pretrial disclosures of information related to informant testimony. Specifically, Texas should require the prosecution to make written disclosures regarding the circumstances of any cooperation agreements and any other information about the credibility of an informant. Such disclosure should occur prior to any criminal trial.
What does that mean? When you just said that the state should disclose any other pertinent information about the source of the testimony, source of the information.
Past history, criminal, past criminal history. Has this person been a paid informant before? They've been on the rolls of the police department has a paid informant, some things like that. Does this person have a prior criminal history?
Can I add something? Some states, including Illinois, require the state to disclose if an informant witness has been offer testimony in other cases in exchange for benefits. So even if it's something separate from the case at hand, we've seen individuals who are sort of serious.
Most interested in, are they giving testimony in some other place at some other time, not just other information. I mean, that could put a burden on the state that may be expensive, isn't it? Depending on who defines pertinent information.
Obviously what we're trying to look out for is patterns of individuals who offer testimony in exchange for consideration in their own cases that raises suspicion about the reliability. And, to the extent that the state is aware of those, of other instances that are in similar cases, then I think that's what they're after.
I can foresee one problem if you have a blanket rule like that. If you have a particularly bad defendant and a jailhouse informant, I can foresee if it's disclosed early, the prospect of intimidation or in fact injury or death to the informant. And so that's another little problem you got.
That's a problem, but again, this is about trying to present the jury with the most reliable and accurate information possible so that they can make a fair and accurate decision in their deliberations.
And that, I think we're all interested in that, but that I just raised the issue that it almost has to be on a case-by-case basis. Because if you have just a blanket rule that it's disclosed, if you're interested in getting accurate and truthful information, it cuts both ways.
Well, one way you can deal with that is one of the other recommendations that we have is that you have reliability hearings. And at that reliability hearing, it's really up to the court to conclude that the informant's testimony is sufficiently reliable to submit to the jury by considering all these factors. Maybe in the reliability hearing, this is when you can bring up this, because it's not in front of the jury, behind closed doors, and you can have this. But what's most important in terms of it is that you have the court making the decision on the reliability of this witness and whether or not we're going to be able to present this testimony to a jury. While evaluating informant testimony, many law enforcement officers and prosecutors seek to corroborate at least a portion of the informant's of the information provided by the informant. Nonetheless, the manner in which they do this oftentimes is a closed-door process. And again, this is nothing other than trying to increase some of the transparency and the oversight and neutrality into the process. In order to do that, I think that Texas prosecutors should be required to disclose and present any information corroborating the witness's testimony. And if a jurisdiction is unable to do so, the facts of this informant testimony, courts should limit the use of such testimony. And again, a lot of this can come out in a reliability hearing. So it's not necessarily in front of the full court.
We don't necessarily do that on any other witness. You're talking about their reliability. Exactly. Any other witness that's out there, do we? Why would we want to do differently?
Because informant testimony has proven to be some of the most unreliable testimony that is out there.
It's also proven to be some of the most important things in dealing with major drug dealers or other aspects of things that are in the public interest.
I totally agree.
Texas has a, and I can't remember the details, but there's a corroboration requirement on some of this kind of testimony before it could be admitted, before somebody could be convicted on it.
Only if it's accomplice, though.
Right.
Isn't there something about informant testimony standing alone that was recently? I can't remember the details on it.
Something on the drugs.
That's what you have built.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, you had asked if that's the only type of defendant. They do have standards that have to be met for expert testimony to be brought in, and the similarity is that just like the expert is being compensated financially, the informant is being compensated by a lesser charge, or in some cases financially themselves. And so you're actually talking about a compensated witness. And so that's why the reliability hearing is being considered.
Again, all we're trying to recommend here is our simple and not costly policy and practices that are just going to increase the quality and reliability of the testimony and the evidence that's before jurors during criminal trials. Let me spend a few minutes talking about forensics and forensic evidence and forensic testimony. Inaccurate forensic evidence and testimony is second only to eyewitness identification error as the leading cause of wrongful convictions in Texas. In Texas, 47% of the wrongful convictions are a result of either false forensic testimony or bad lab practices or whatnot. Especially in recent years, forensic science has been increasingly relied upon in criminal justice systems as a powerful tool for seeking the truth and justice. The use of forensic science can effectively help convict those guilty of crimes, and it equally helps exonerate the innocent. However, forensic science, as we all know, is not flawless, and its use in the criminal justice system is in great need of reform. The common perception of forensic analysis as precise, objective science often obscures the fact that many areas of forensic analysis involve discretionary interpretation by individual analysts. There are many cases where individual analysts' erroneous or misleading analysis and testimony have led to wrongful convictions. Here in Texas, investigators discovered, for example, that forensic pathologist Ralph Erdman was faking his autopsies, but not before his testimony was used in 20 or more death penalty cases. Additionally, forensic crime labs frequently lack safeguards necessary to prevent the introduction of erroneous forensic analysis in the courtroom. We all know the story of the Houston Police Department's crime lab and what went on there, and the extraordinary investigation done by Bromwich. It was found that analysts at the crime lab repeatedly tested DNA samples incorrectly, and in some cases made up results without actually testing the evidence. Independent investigations have revealed that the lab did not perform or performed incomplete serology work in over 400 cases. In addition to the retesting in many cases, including four death penalty cases, the investigations proved innocence of three men who were wrongfully convicted with erroneous testing and analyst testimony. Clearly, a lack of oversight over forensic labs in Texas has had devastating consequences on the accuracy of the criminal justice system at a time when courts are increasingly relying on forensic evidence. Fortunately, Texas has also taken some extraordinary steps to deal with this. The establishment of the Texas Forensic Science Commission provides an independent body to review allegations of forensic negligence and misconduct and recommends corrective action. This need for this type of substantive independent forensic oversight is paramount, and I commend the state for doing taking this step. And Texas has done a great job of making this commission fully independent, which it needs to be, and staffing it with experts not only in forensic science, but other areas of science as well, to ensure that the commission has depth and is represented by experienced members from all aspects of the scientific community. However, if you look, take a look at the mandate of the commission, I believe it's only fits the bill halfway. The statutory tasks of the Forensic Science Commission are essentially backward-looking: to institute a reporting mechanism for labs to record allegations of negligence or misconduct, and to investigate claims of negligence or misconduct. While the commission is able to make these recommendations for remedial actions, it's primarily oriented to be a reactive body. While the progress that the commission has made is positive, I believe that it's essential to establish a forensic oversight system, or give the Forensic Science Commission's power to be more proactive in setting quality standards in order to ensure that the best evidence possible makes it into court. I've read mention in the press, and Edwin has told me about Judge Schreiber's idea of developing a system of unannounced lab inspections and retesting, which could be placed under the auspices of the Science Commission. Your recommendation, Judge Schreiber, is an example of what I'm talking about, and that the state recognizing that you cannot outsource forensic science quality control, that it has to be involved in setting and enforcing standards for the quality of forensic evidence. And one thing that I would encourage you to keep in mind as you develop and work on forensic proposals is that while DNA gets all the attention, forensic labs are also engaged in a variety of sub-disciplines beyond DNA. And the need for oversight and quality standards in those areas is very great. The proactive quality assurance role the state takes must address all aspects of forensic science that are relied upon in criminal trials, just not DNA evidence. One way to do this is simply to help establish standards and qualifications for analysts. Currently, there are no standards for qualification of analysts across the various forensic subdivisions. We believe that there should be minimum qualification standards, including requiring analysts to obtain appropriate certification and complete continuing education requirements. Standards that would be established by the Science Commission or any oversight body. While some labs may only hire qualified analysts, the lack of official standards make it impossible to guarantee that every lab is staffed with qualified analysis. I can tell you that I had one science course in college that was geology, and I got a D in it, that I could walk into labs around the country and get a job as an analyst. That's the state and the nature of a lot of crime labs around here, because they don't have standards and qualifications.
Can I comment on that?
Yes, please.
Yeah, can't do that here.
Okay. Texas is one of four states in the U.S. that requires crime labs to be accredited.
Right.
To be accredited, you have to have standards for the hiring of forensic scientists. Most positions in a crime lab, you've got to have a science degree. And furthermore, once you hire those people, you have to provide them training, you have to provide them competency testing, you have to do proficiency testing, at least annually. We have all that in place in Texas right now.
Yeah, the most important thing is to maintain the oversight and control of what those standards and qualifications are. Accreditation, while very important and really necessary, doesn't guarantee that the lab is going to produce good results. You know, you can still have problems in the lab. In fact, recently there was a MassCLAD lab, Bodie Technologies in Virginia. It does a lot of work for the state of Virginia and a number of jurisdictions around the country. Accredited. Was under a contract to do some work for the state of Illinois, returned a whole bunch of samples to the state of Illinois and their state police department, which oversees their crime lab, saying that there was no DNA evidence in these 20 cases, that there were no semen samples or anything. in the state of Illinois Police Department, their crime lab went back and looked at it. They found evidence in there. So, you know, you can have accreditation, but again, you got to make sure that the standards are set up, and Texas is doing very, very good in that regard. But you got to make sure that there are standards, you got to make sure that there are qualifications, and you need the oversight body to oversee this process. And again, here in the state of Texas, it's a great start of what the Science Commission is doing, but let's just not be reactive. Let's give the Science Commission, you know, more power so they can get out there and be more proactive in this process.
Before you leave that, who in the room knows how many full-time equivalent slots do we have in that commission? I've just forgotten.
The only staff person that there's a budget line for is a single paralegal based at San
Diego. See, that's the problem. It was created. I'm on appropriation. It just seemed like taking me a while to get back to our customer. It's set up. But by golly, there's no FTs in it. And there's virtually no appropriation to it. And the whole idea is that it would be the ones to look at the labs and so forth, and I think your idea of being proactive as opposed to reactive is excellent. But, and in no way am I trying to demean the commission, I'm simply saying I think it's a turtle created on its back. And if we're going to blush it and leave it here in your testimony, that's fine. However, we might want to go back in and look at that really, really carefully as we take your charges to us or your suggestions to us and be sure that in fact, they have the tools and the personnel to do what you're suggesting.
To not leave the wrong impression about the budget for the commission, they did get a substantial budget of hundreds of thousands of dollars in order to retain investigators to conduct some of these investigations where there's been a complaint. But again, I think, as John's saying, that's essentially reacting to
the contract labor. For contract labor personnel.
To hire independent, yes, basically.
We'll review it this session carefully and be sure that it's got the tools and dollars that it needs to do its job. Thank you.
You know, the oversight of forensics here and what this commission should evaluate is also, you know, for private accreditation programs and supplement those private accreditation programs with operational training, administrative, and scientific standards. For example, the state of Maryland has adopted a model mechanism for ensuring quality forensic evidence. And in Maryland, forensic laboratories are required to be licensed by an oversight body in order to operate in the state or offer forensic evidence, forensic services in the state. The labs must meet standards set by the oversight body in order to qualify for a license. And that oversight body in Maryland is within the Department of Health and Dental Hygiene. And so the types of quality standards and qualifications are going to mirror those standards and requirements coming out of a medical lab, medical clinical lab, which quite honestly are much more stringent and much more useful. That's exactly what, something along those lines should be done here in Texas. One standard that I think needs to happen quite specifically included is a requirement for blind proficiency testing. ASCLAD, in their accreditation process, does not require that a lab undergo blind proficiency testing. That is very, very important in terms of making sure that the testing in which the analyst is being evaluated, that they're that they don't know anything about it. That's one of the best ways to ensure that your lab is doing things correctly. In fact, one 2006 study conducted by the Journal of Forensic Identification asked experienced analysts to evaluate a series of fingerprints to determine if they matched. These analysts believed that they were examining prints from an open, unsolved case, but they were in fact re-examining prints that they had previously analyzed correctly. Okay? So this was the test that they did. They gave these analysts, experienced analysts, fingerprint test, right, to analyze. They thought that they were analyzing an open case, but there are actually cases that they had already made correct analysis to. And in cases where the analysts were given contextual information about the fingerprints, they were wrong in almost 17% of the cases. Okay? So we talk about in terms of inadvertent bias. But testing of this stuff and getting that inadvertent bias that can occur in the lab is very, very important. I believe that the study highlights the need to ensure that contextual information does not undermine the objectivity of analysis by ensuring labs are independent of law enforcement and prosecutorial agencies. And I recognize that most jurisdictions that is not the case. What is most important is that the lab operate as if it is. I have spoken before a number of forensic people and crime lab people around the country, and in their ideal world, almost to a person, they all said we would prefer to be independent of law enforcement. We want you to know that the way that we conduct our practices and the way our standards are, we maintain our scientific neutrality. Let me just spend a minute or two on post-conviction DNA testing. There was a lot of discussion of that this morning, so I'm not going to go into great detail about it. As I said earlier, Texas has one of the best laws in the country when it deals with post-conviction DNA testing, especially when it comes to preservation of that evidence. However, it's one thing to pass a law, it's another thing to make sure that it gets implemented properly. And so something needs to happen here in Texas, be it education, letting people know what the requirements are, and maybe even introducing some type of sanction, you know, for jurisdictions that fail to follow the law. Maybe something as simple as holding the people in contempt of court or something like that. But there has to be something. As I'm sure you probably already know, and it's something, quite honestly, that I take a little bit of pride in. The state of Texas recently received a $500,000 grant from the Department of Justice under the Kirk Bloodsworth Post-Conviction DNA program. And that grant is going to assist the state in reducing the backlog of cases to be reviewed in sexual assault cases and to provide funds for testing. This program was authorized as part of the Innocence Protection Act in the U.S. Congress, which became law in 2004. And the Justice Project led the five-year campaign to pass this law, and I'm very pleased that finally, after all these years, these much-needed funds are finally getting out and being put to use here in Texas and in other states around the country. Finally, I just want to spend a couple moments about talking about something that, quite frankly, outrages me the most than anything else when it comes to wrongful convictions, and that's bad lawyering. And when I say bad lawyering, I mean on both sides of the aisle, from prosecutorial misconduct to incompetent defense counsels and to judges and boards of professional responsibility who sanction such behavior. Later on this year, the Justice Project is going to be publishing two additional policy reviews dealing with prosecutorial accountability and adequate counsel. But a few words on adequate counsel. As we all know, at the heart of a reliable criminal justice system is access to adequate defense representation. Our adversarial system of justice breaks down when criminal defendants are not represented by committed attorneys who vigorously question the facts and subject the prosecution's case to scrutiny. Even if all the above reforms and practices are implemented, they are of no use to criminal defendants without adequate legal representation. And the only way faulty eyewitness testimony, improper interrogation tactics, unreliable informant testimony, false forensic evidence or testimony, or DNA evidence proving innocence can be introduced in a criminal trial is by a competent and qualified defense attorney. The most important safeguard in preventing wrongful convictions is effective legal assistance. Unfortunately, there is no doubt that there is a pervasive national problem in the quality of legal representation afforded to indigent criminal defendants in this country. Fortunately, the state of Texas has taken crucial steps toward improving indigent defense. The passage of the Fair Defense Act is an enormously important step forward, and now with the Task Force on indigent defense, and under the extraordinary leadership of Judge Keller and Mr. Betke, you're in a position to foster new, more effective systems for delivering defense services in Texas. And it's truly been extraordinary what has happened since the passage of the Bear Defense Act. I think there are now 14, is that? 15 public defender offices that are being supported by the task force. The bottom line regarding wrongful convictions and indigent defense is this. You have to have a system that provides oversight and accountability. You have to have a system that provides an institutional basis for professional development, supervision, and mentoring, and specialization in order to ensure quality defense representation. Public defender systems can provide these things in ways that appointed counsel can never will. Of course, even in an effective structure, it will fail if reasonable caseload standards and funding are not provided. The work that the task force has been doing, moving toward a more effective delivery models for indigent defense, must continue if Texas is truly reduced the risk of wrongful convictions. You know, I recognize that we've talked for a long time here, and some of the things that I'm recommending, you know, present a daunting challenge and also represent an extraordinary commitment. But I also believe that this only underscores the gravity of the problem. As Governor Perry has stated, quote, there's nothing more abhorrent to the criminal justice system than the conviction of an innocent person. And our challenge as a state is to enact reforms that ensure preventable errors never happen again, unquote. Wrongful convictions pose a risk to public safety, the life and liberty of innocent, law-abiding citizens, and they undermine public confidence and trust in a system that is designed to protect them. The state of Texas, through some of the recommendations I have discussed, and through the formation of this body, certainly understands the need to modernize and reform our criminal justice system. I commend you for your efforts. I encourage you to continue, as I know you will, and we will help you and assist you in any way that we can. Thank you for your patience.
Is there any body that's working on how to deal with people who are in prison on bad eyewitness evidence where there's no DNA, on how to approach that issue?
No, there really is. I mean, there really isn't, and that's part of the problem, you know. In a lot of jurisdictions, even higher, it's very difficult to get a conviction overturned even based on DNA evidence.
Let me ask you, is the studies and the evidence that have come out about the problems with eyewitness testimony that you were referring to earlier, are those going to rise to the level of scientific evidence that you could take those studies and apply them to a 20-year-old case if you were able to construct how the identification was done and say that this scientific evidence shows the unreliability of that identification?
I think it will get there. I'm not sure that it's necessarily there yet. And that's something I would ask Gary. But yeah, I think it'll get there. It's one of the interesting things about you know, what has really transpired over the last 10, 15, even 20 years. You know, we all recognize the importance of, you know, the hard sciences, the DNA and everything like that. And we utilize the hard sciences to help us improve our criminal justice system. The phenomena that has occurred, you know, through the work of people like Gary Wells and Steve Grissom and others, is that it's really brought into focus the importance of social science into the criminal justice system, and what good research in social science can bring to help us understand why some of these wrongful convictions happen. What is the science behind how human memory works, or human psychology works, or why someone would confess to a crime that they never committed. And that type of scientific understanding has led to, quite frankly, you know, these types of recommendations and solutions to the problem.
Do you have any information yet? It may be too early, but I know the state of New Jersey had an eyewitness ID statute passed several years ago. Have you been able to capture any information yet as to whether that statute and the difference in how identifications are performed, how that impacts what happens to cases that the prosecutors have. In other words, if they use that and find out there's a problem with the witness's ID, are they not going to trial?
You haven't collected that, but that's very good to follow up on. Do you know of any studies that have looked at that?
I know that the certainly the anecdotal evidence out of New Jersey has been that there's been no appreciable, that things have not become more difficult in bringing cases, that it hasn't been used as an impediment for getting evidence in. But Gary, when Gary Wells speaks to you all, I think he's been in close contact with the Attorney General's office in New Jersey and has asked, you know, requested a lot of feedback, and is probably in a better position to share with you what the people on the ground have been saying about it from that.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
I do have another question.
Yeah, John, could you share a little bit about additional funding sources under the Innocence Protection Act, or if there's anything else that's coming?
Jim had asked me about this earlier this morning, and I just forgot about it. The Innocence Protection Act, when it was passed, provided two sources of funding. One was called the Kirk Ledgewood Post-Conviction DNA Testing Program, which I talked briefly about. And the other program became known eventually as a capital litigation program. What that program established was a funding mechanism of grants from the Department of Justice for states who are working to build effective systems of representation, especially in capital cases. There was a lot of discussion when that legislation was working its way through Congress, and there became known as the Texas carve-out. What the Texas carve-out became was, because Texas had the Fair Defense Act already on the books, instead of it being tied to requirements that were set forth in the legislation on what it means to have an effective system of representation, which quite honestly are nothing other than the ABA guidelines on defense representation, the measure by which Texas is judged and whether or not they can apply for these grants is how they are complying with the Fair Defense Act. Again, it's one thing to get legislation passed. It's always another thing to make sure it's implemented correctly. It's even another thing to make sure that money is actually put into the program. In the congressional 2008 budget, there was funding that was put into the program, which was tied to the Innocence Protection Act. And so I do not believe that the Department of Justice has issued the regulations on that grant program. But I would suggest that if the state of Texas made some inquiries into the Department of Justice in terms of how they're administering these funds, just as the state of Texas and Governor Perry's office made the inquiry under the Kirk Ledgewood program, then it'd get the Department of Justice thinking. So, yes.
Right. Do you know the states that got the Bloodsworth money? There's like five of them. I don't need to know the states, but
I can tell you the states.
Do they already, do most of them, and I don't think Texas has developed their plans to what they're going to do with the money. Do you know if any of the other states have developed a plan? I mean, does it only have to go to testing? Can it go toward?
No, let's see. Just get along here. The state of Washington, I'll tell you what, the state of Washington got $250,000. And what they're looking to do with that is, they say there's an estimated 200 case files at the Innocence Project Northwest that have yet to, where data has yet to be reviewed, and there's an additional 145 inmate requests above and beyond those. And so money's going to help with paralegals to go through this stuff, and also they're going to hire some forensic scientists to help with the analysis. This one is, this is the state of Texas, and I already talked about using that one before. The Arizona Criminal Justice Commission is getting $1.3 million. And They're going to do that three things. First, address the need for resources for pending evaluation of cases. Second part of the proposal is to do a comprehensive canvassing and review of inmate population in Arizona to locate all the unresolved murder and non-negligent homicide cases and provide some money for DNA testing. Kentucky's getting $1 million dealing with their backlog situation. Virginia got several million dollars to deal with their backlog.
Thank you.
Judge, can I just respond to a couple of questions from the guys earlier that I wanted to try to help answer? Bill, I also mentioned that on eyewitness certainty, that there's a great deal of research that really cast doubt on eyewitness certainty being closely correlated with accuracy. That's true, and one of the reasons that we focused on efforts to document the eyewitness identification procedure is that to the extent that it is helpful and valuable to know how certain the eyewitness feels, it's helpful and valuable to figure out how the eyewitness feels at the time that he or she makes an identification as opposed to much later. So I do...
Who did that research?
There's a lot of different studies. Gary Wells could be helpful to you. I could send you some studies. But a number of social scientists have been looking very closely at the connection or lack thereof between certainty and accuracy.
You'll find all of those on Gary Wells' website.
And he'll be here in October.
And one other quick thing, going back to Mr. Johnson's point about the accreditation program and the fact that labs in Texas are required to be accredited, and that any accreditation program are standards for education and qualifications, and that's correct. And one of the things that we are strongly in favor of accreditation, but we believe that the state has opportunities to augment the requirements that are in the accreditation. And just one example, the requirements for proficiency testing that are strictly required by the most common accreditation program can be satisfied technically, and I don't know that your labs don't go beyond this, but can be satisfied technically if one individual in a department is tested. And so what we would suggest is that, and your labs may well be going beyond that to make sure everybody's tested, but while that provides a very important baseline, we think that the opportunities exist to augment and build upon accreditation to make sure we get qualified.
Yes, sir.
Just a couple of things real quickly. Our lab just received a notification just this past week from Congressman Lamar Smith that we just received another $137,000 for DNA backlog testing. We've been very successful for the last 3 years to pursue the grant fund through the NIJ and the Commonwealth grants for DNA testing. It's just a matter of time before we run across one. We have 700 cases now that we're looking at, sexual assault cases that we're going back to look at now. So it's just a matter of time before we hit one of those innocent ones. But we also tie ourselves to the fact that we're not only using DNA testing to identify the guilty, but to also recuse the innocent. But I also wanted to state that our lab also happens to be one of those labs that has a CODIS index that's located in it for the FBI, which is the Convicted Offender Index Bank, located in our lab, which means that our lab also comes under the scrutiny, our DNA lab comes under the scrutiny of audits from the FBI, which we go through on a regular basis. We also have our supervisor, as a technical supervisor, who's certified. So we have the additional assurances in our DNA lab, having technical supervisors who are certified through the federal government as well as the state to provide quality assurance inspections.
I've
invited the folks out to our lab to sit down to share with them that, because that's the number one issue with it is quality assurance.
You know how many other detective labs had that?
We're the only one.
You're the only one.
DPS is the only, the state has that, but we're the only municipal police agencies that has that inside that lab.
Okay.
But we provided testimony at the Innocence Project, Rodney Ellison's presentation, that we welcome additional scrutiny also. We have actually made suggestion that perhaps through TCOS that we look at some licensing issue for standardization of scientists, not only in the DNA field, but in the latent print field, because we have some false applications for that, as well as our crime scene, for instance. Our crime scene unit at the Austin Police Department is ASPI certified, and we're only one crime scene unit in probably 20 in the country that's gone through ASPI certification. Because what sometimes we often forget is it all starts there. If evidence is not collected properly, everything else you do in past that is no good. So we're inviting some folks out to come and visit with us so we can further discuss this.
I can answer that question. There are 15 government forensic DNA labs in Texas that are accredited in that, and 14 of those have the CODIS terminals that he's referencing. And he's right that if you've got one of those, you get an external inspection every 2 years in accordance with what we all know is the FBI audit document, which is it's a thorough inspection.
Any other questions? Well, thank you all. Our next meeting is October 30th, and welcome you all to return. We'll have very well, and we'll let you know what else is on the agenda. But keep sending your ideas in. We'll appreciate it. Thank you.
Super good. Take care. God bless.